So welcome to session number 5 of our series about Parshanut and polemics. Let me share my screen here with you. Last week, we started studying about Rashi and Rashi's, whether Rashi was a polemicist, whether Rashi was taking on Christianity in his commentaries on the Bible. And last week, we talked about Rashi's commentaries on Nach, on the prophets and the writings, on Nevi'im and Ketuvim. And we saw solid proof of a number of things. Rashi, first of all, he uses the word minim quite often. Minim means sectarians, but it's also a code word for Christians. The question that'll come up today in today's session, when Rashi uses the word minim, is he necessarily referring to Christians? And some of the passages that we saw last time, there was no doubt about it. Rashi says a number of times that he says explicitly that he's offering explanations of biblical passages that will be useful, lichuvat haminim, to refute the explanations of the minim. And we know that there are Christian explanations on those passages, and so that's solid proof that he is taking on the Christians. Rashi says explicitly that some of those explanations that he was offering differ sharply from what the classical rabbis had said. We saw, he says, the rabbi said that this is talking about the Mashiach, about the Messiah, but for polemical reasons, it's probably a good strategy for us to say that this passage is not about the about the Messiah. That's pretty strong dedication to arguing with the Christians, that he's willing to even go against the traditions of some of the classical rabbis on these passages. We finished the session last week by seeing at least one text, and there are others in the prophets where Rashi doesn't explicitly say that he is offering an explanation in order to counter the claims of the Christians, but it's obvious that that is what he is doing, that when he comes up with his innovative explanation of the suffering servant at the end of the book of Isaiah, it's because he knows that the Christians have interpreted the suffering servant about Jesus. Okay, so that's what we saw last week. And now we go backwards. Last week, we were looking at Rashi's commentary on the later books of the Bible, the prophets and the writings, the Nach. And now we go back to Rashi's commentary on the Torah. So first thing we notice is that in Rashi's commentary on the Torah, the word min or minim appears a grand total of 4 times. And 3 of those times are quotations from classical rabbinic sources. So he's, you know, at least from that kind of arithmetical point of view, he's not dealing with the minim very much. And so there's never a place where he says that I am offering this explanation that differs from the explanation of the classical rabbis in order to refute the Christians. That never happens in his commentary on the Torah. Now, this is, of course, the argument from silence that, you know, didn't find that he said this. That doesn't mean that he isn't doing it. So we will also ask the question here today, are there comments where Rashi takes on Christianity in his commentary on the Torah without saying that that is what he is doing? So that's today's agenda, to look at this. So the first thing we're going to look at is those passages, or at least a couple of those passages, where Rashi does use the word min or minim, which could mean a non-believer or could mean a Christian. Here, Rashi uses the word minim in his commentary on Deuteronomy chapter 32, and he says about the phrase, Begoy naval achisem, I will vex them with a foolish nation, with a nation of fools. What are fools? Rashi wants to explain what fools are. And he says, this refers to the minim. As it is written, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. So Rashi says, Rashi compares the word naval in Psalms to the word naval in Deuteronomy, and says that just as in Tehillim, in Psalms, the word refers to a non-believer, somebody who says that there is no God. So also that's the reference here to a nation of fools. It's a nation of people who don't believe in God. Obviously, this isn't Christianity that he's referring to. When he uses the word minim here, he's referring to atheists and not to Christians. Christians are not atheists. The problem that Judaism has with Christianity is that there are too many gods, not that it's an atheistic religion. So here's a clear passage where Rashi uses the word minim, and it is obviously not a reference to Christians. The one time that Rashi uses the word minim without quoting it from a classical rabbinic source is on Rashi's commentary on what does it mean when it says that God felt upset that he had created man. This is in the just before the flood comes. It says that God was saddened. It says in Hebrew, "Vayitatzev el libo." Then Rashi says, "V'zo katavti lichuvat haminim," and the following explanation I'm giving in order to refute the arguments of the minim. And then he quotes a classical rabbinic explanation and says that this classical rabbinic explanation is useful for refuting the arguments of the minim. I'll read it in English just to save time. Those of you who wish can follow along in the Hebrew. A Gentile once asked Rabbi Joshua, the son of Korcha, "Do you not admit that the Blessed Holy One knows what is to happen in the future?" He replied, "Yes, of course God knows what will happen in the future." The Gentile retorted, "But is it not written, 'And he was saddened'?" In other words, that God had created human beings and he was like happy that he created human beings, and then he became sad. So this shows that God changes his mind, is what the Gentile is saying, or that God didn't know in advance what's going to happen. So Rabbi Joshua ben Korcha answered, "Have you ever had a son born to you?" The reply was, "Yes." He asked the Gentile, "And what did you do when your baby was born?" He replied, "I rejoiced, and I brought others to rejoice with me." The rabbi asked him, I think somebody is unmuted, and if everyone could mute themselves because there are some background noises, that would be good. The rabbi asked him, "But did you not know that your son is destined to die? Why were you happy when your son was born if you knew that he was going to die?" The heathen replied, "At the time of joy, let there be joy. At the time of mourning, let there be mourning. Bishat chedvata chedvata, bishat efla efla." Of course, you're happy at the time that you're happy, and you mourn at the time that you mourn. The rabbi then said, "Such too is the way of the Blessed Holy One." That's what it means here to say that God was saddened, as if that there's a change here in God because something has happened. Okay, so that's this old midrash that Rashi quotes here, and he says that he's quoting this midrash to refute the arguments of the minim. It appears to me that the arguments of the minim that Rashi is referring to here must be the argument that God doesn't know things in advance. That's what the Gentile was trying to prove here in this story, that God couldn't know things in advance. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been sad when people sinned in the days of Noah. This is evidence that God doesn't know things in advance. And that's never been a Christian doctrine. So here where Rashi is saying that I am writing this, li tshuvat haminim, in order to deflect the arguments of the non-believers, of the heretics, he is not referring to Christians. Last week in the text that we saw, he was clearly referring to Christians. Here, he is not referring to Christians. I've given you two out of the four examples of Rashi using the word minim in his commentary on the Torah. The other two are, again, quotations from classical rabbinic literature where the rabbis said that here's what the minim said. And it's unclear in those passages whether the classical rabbis were referring to Christians or to some other group of Jewish sectarians in those passages. But we have no example of Rashi saying, I'm giving some new interpretation here, and I'm doing it because I know what the minim are saying in the way that we saw last week in his commentary on the prophets and on the writings. So that doesn't happen in his commentary on the Torah. So now we go on to the second part of the question that I posed. How reasonable is the argument to say that Rashi, although he doesn't explicitly say that he's arguing against the Christians, maybe he is arguing against the Christians in his commentary on the Torah without saying so? Okay. So let's look at his commentary here on Genesis chapter 15, the chapter that's known as Brit Ben HaBetarim, the covenant between the pieces. It begins with a discussion between Abram and God. God, in the first couple of verses that I didn't quote here, promises many things to Abraham, many good things. And then Abram says here in the top verse here, since you have granted me no offspring, my steward will be my heir. You know, I've got a butler here, the guy who's in charge of my home. He's going to be inheriting everything. So, you know, what good? It's as if Avram is saying, what good are all these promises when I have no heirs? And then it says, the word of the Lord came to him in reply. Lo yirashcha zeh, ki im asher yetzei mimeecha hu yirashcha. That one won't be your heir. None but your very own issue shall be your heir. You shall have children, and your children will be your heirs. And then it says, he took him outside and he said, look towards heaven, count the stars if you are able to count them. And he added, so shall your offspring be. Ko yeh zarecha, promise that the Jews would turn into a large people. Okay, I gave you the translation of the first three verses, but I did not give you the translation here of the last verse that's on the left-hand side here in the Hebrew. The verse reads, "Ve'emin b'shem v'yachsheveha lo tzedakah." I'm not going to translate that right now either, because I'm going to show you that there's more than one way of understanding this phrase. And actually, those of you who have very good memories will remember that we saw this phrase 4 weeks ago, and we saw a Christian interpretation of this phrase, "Ve'emin b'Hashem v'yachsheveha lo tzedakah." We saw it in Paul's epistle to the Romans back in the middle of the in the first century. Paul writing about how you become a righteous person, and Paul tries to read this verse as proving that one becomes a righteous person through faith and not through action. Just to review this text that we saw 4 weeks ago. Now, some of you weren't here 4 weeks ago, so see it for the first time, unless you're well acquainted already with the epistle to the Romans. What then shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, discovered in this matter? If in fact Abraham was justified by works, if you think that Abraham became a righteous person by the things that he did, then he had something to boast about, but not before God. But what does Scripture say? Scripture says Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. He quotes that verse, "Ve'emin b'Hashem v'yachsheveha lo tzedakah." In other words, This is how Paul is understanding that passage back there in Genesis. God is making promises here to Abraham. Abraham's saying at the beginning, look, I don't have any children. What good is all the are all the blessings that I've been given? And God says to him, don't worry, you're going to have children, and you will turn into a large people. And Abraham believed that. And Paul understands the end of the verse here to be saying, and vayachsheveha lo tzedaka, and God thought that Abraham's faith was what made him into a righteous person. That's how Paul understands it here. Now, to the one who works, wages aren't credited as a gift, but as an obligation. However, to the one who does not work, but trusts God, who justifies the ungodly, their faith is credited as righteousness. So it's Abraham's faith that's making him into being righteous. It's not a barter system here, says Paul, that Abraham does something and then God does something for him in return, but it's all an act of grace that's based simply on faith in Paul's understanding. And Paul goes on, is this blessedness only for the circumcised or also for the uncircumcised? Well, we've been saying that Abraham's faith was credited to him as righteousness. And under what circumstances was it credited? This verse that we quoted was from Genesis chapter 15. Was it after he was circumcised or was it before he was circumcised, says Paul? It was not after, it was before. He doesn't become circumcised until chapter 17. But still, he's being called righteous in chapter 15 because he believes in God, and he received circumcision as a sign, a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. And so we see, Paul says here, proof in this biblical text that faith is what makes you into a righteous person, that it isn't mitzvot that make you, it isn't action, the tension there between faith and works, that works is not what matters. What matters is faith. And Abraham had faith, and that's what made him into a righteous person. Okay, so that's what the Christians, beginning with Paul in the middle of the first century, were teaching. And this Christian teaching continued, particularly it was picked up by Protestant Christianity, where Protestant Christianity, before Protestantism arose, that people were, of course, Christians were also following the teaching in Romans, but Martin Luther argued that the Catholics had fallen away from the path that Paul had set here in Romans, and they had gotten into all these ceremonies and all these actions, and Christianity ought to be based on faith and should not be based on action. Okay. What do the Jewish commentators say about this verse? Well, first of all, let us notice that there is an ambiguity here in the syntax in the verse. So you have on the left, v'hemin b'ashem v'yachsheveha lo tzedakah, and on the right, I give you the two different ways of understanding the syntax here of the verse. The first one is Paul's understanding of the syntax. He believed in God. He, meaning God, reckoned it for him, meaning Abram, as merit. Vayachsheveha, the subject, for those of you who are into grammatical terminology, vayachsheveha, the subject of the verb vayachsheveha is God. God reckoned it, and we have the pronoun appearing afterwards, lo, for him. Who is him? Him is Abram. God reckoned it for him as merit. But there is the other way of understanding this verse, that he believed in God, and he, the subject of the verb, is now Abram. He considered it, meaning God's promise, a free gift from him, from God. That's what this verse means. That God made this promise to Abraham, and Abraham believed God, and he said, oh, that's really nice. I consider this a tzedakah, a free gift, something special that God is doing on my behalf. As we shall see in a minute, most Jewish commentators, or at least an extremely large number of Jewish commentators, follow the second understanding. Just because it's an interesting text here, I give you an example from the reconstructed Rashbam on Genesis 15. Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, who we will be talking about next week, and his attitude towards Christians and Christianity. His commentary on Genesis chapters 2 through 17 is lost. And a scholar here in Jerusalem named Hillel Nevetsky has done a really interesting project of trying to reconstruct Rashbam's commentary on Genesis 15. Hillel wrote a doctoral dissertation at Haifa University that was just accepted a little more than a year ago, which was his arguments for this reconstructing of parts of Rashbam's commentary on Genesis 15. I think that the argument that Hillel has about this specific passage is very strong. I think that there are many reasons to think that this is Rashbam's lost comment on Genesis 15. If it isn't Rashbam's lost comment on Genesis 15, it's some other rabbi from the 12th century. So probably Rashbam, and if not Rashbam, some other rabbi from the 12th century writes, Abram believed what God had promised him, that he would have a child. And Abram thought that God was doing him a favor, a tzedakah, and that it was not because of his own merit. Rather, it was tzedakah and God's mercy on him. Zehu ikar pshuto, a standard Rashbam phrase. This is the true plain meaning of the text. As for those who say that the phrase means that God considered Abraham's faith as tzedakah and that God graciously accepted Abraham's faith, they are mistaken. So Rashbam here at the end quotes, I think, the standard Christian understanding of the text, the understanding of the text that we saw in Paul's epistle to the Romans, and says that that is a mistaken understanding of the verse. Is Rashbam saying this for polemical anti-Christian purposes? A good chance that it's the case that he is doing so. Can't say for certain. He doesn't say that he's relating to Christ, but it's distinctly possible. And I started with this Rashbam just for the fun of it, in order to give some publicity to the wonderful project done by Hillel Nevetsky. But you'll see here, Samuel David Luzzatto in Italy, in the beginning of the 19th century, in his commentary on Genesis chapter 15, writes, Abraham considered what God had promised him tzedakah. He considered it an act of grace, something special. So Abraham is the subject of the verb by Achshaveha. Abraham thought that what God has promised him was tzedakah. And he lists here, Shadal naturally did not have a chance of reading Hillel Nevetsky's doctoral dissertation and knowing about this reconstructed Rashbam. So he lists Torah commentators over the years who interpreted the verse this way, following the interpretation of Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, Ramban, Gersonides, Rabbi Isaac Arama, Abarbanel, and then Shadal lists a few less well-known commentators who also say that this is a very common Jewish interpretation of the verse, that the subject of the phrase Vayachsheveha, that it's the second model here. He, Abraham, considered it God's promise, a free gift from him, from God, and it isn't the one on top, which is Paul's understanding of it. And then Shadal, who lived in Italy, where at the beginning of the 19th century, the Jews and Christians got along fairly well in those days. So he wasn't strongly into polemics against Christianity, but still he writes here, the end of this, in the second paragraph here, the idea, however, that faith should be thought of as something that makes a person righteous contradicts logic and contradicts the Torah and the prophets, that you become righteous by having faith. He says, which is, of course, the teaching of Paul and the teaching of many generations of Christianity, Chadal says, you know, it's illogical to say something. The thing that makes me righteous are the things that I do, not the thoughts and feelings that I have in my mind, the faith that I have. That isn't what makes me into a righteous person. That contradicts logic and it contradicts the Torah and the prophets. And Chadal knows very well what Paul taught in Romans, and he's arguing against that kind of understanding of the verse. This is supposed to be a session about Rashi, and I've been talking about everybody except for Rashi, because this was all to show you the contrast with what Rashi writes on Genesis 15:6. Rashi writes, Vayachsheveha lo tzedakah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu chishva l'Abraham lizchut al ha'emuna she'emin bo. The Blessed Holy One accounted unto Abraham the faith with which he had trusted him as a merit. That's his zchut, that Abraham gets zchut because of this emuna, that his faith is what makes him into somebody good. Now, obviously, Rashi is not advocating a Christian understanding of faith versus works, but he thinks that that's what this verse means. He thinks that the first understanding of the syntax here is a better understanding of the syntax. Does he know what Paul taught in Romans? I don't know. Maybe he knows what Paul said in Romans. I consider it unlikely that he knows what Paul said in Romans, and I consider it unlikely that he would be writing this if he knew that this was the basis of the Christian teaching of the superiority of faith over works, when we have, as Chatal points out, all of these commentators, all of these Jewish commentators who came up with a different understanding of it. So in a place where many Jewish commentators are offering an interpretation that is trying to undercut Paul's understanding of Genesis 15:6, Rashi in his commentary on Genesis 15:6 understands the syntax, the order of the words here, what's the subject and what's the indirect object. He understands it the same way that Paul does, not because he agrees with Paul about theology, but because he thinks that's what the verse means. Okay, so here's Rashi. This is Rashi's first opportunity here to offer an interpretation of a verse that that's quoted in many Christian sources to try to support Christian theology, and Rashi passes. He does not take the bait. He does not decide to try to refute Christianity in his commentary on Genesis 15:6. Look at another example of a verse that is commonly quoted in Christian circles, one of the verses that's considered a Christological verse by the Christians, a verse that is a prophecy about Jesus in the Bible. In the blessing that's given to Judah in Genesis chapter 49, it says, you have the Hebrew here on the left, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda umuchokek mi ben raglav ad ki yavo shilo, velo yikat amim. This is poetry, and we talked about last week about it's often difficult to understand poetry, and the last six words of this verse are difficult. You have the JPS understanding at the top on the right. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, so that tribute shall come to him, and the homage of peoples be his. The word yikat is, unattested anywhere else in the Bible, and so it's really not clear what it means. But it's saying that Judah will be in charge, and Judah, of course, became the leading tribe. And tribute will come to him, and the homage of peoples will be his. That's the Jewish Publication Society translation. The King James translation preserves the old Christian understanding of this verse, as the King James translation would naturally too, and writes, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be." Yikat is understood in King James, and I think by most Christians, as relating to the root Kuf Hey Lamed. I don't know what happened to the Lamed. There is no Lamed there, and that's referring to gathering or assembly, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So that's the common Christian understanding, and we see it already in the second century in the dialogue of Justin Martyr, the church father, with Trypho the Jew. He quotes this passage, and Justin says, this is the oldest text that I could find. Maybe somebody said it before Justin, but Christians continue to say it from the time of Justin on. He speaks, therefore, in the passage relating to Judah, a prince shall not fail from Judah, nor a ruler from his thighs, till that which is laid up for him come, and he shall be the expectation of the nations. And it is plain that this was spoken not of Judah, but of Christ. So Justin Martyr said this is a clear prophecy about Jesus in the book of Genesis. And this is it's not just Justin, it's a common teaching from the time of Justin to the time of Rashi and beyond the time of Rashi. And what does Rashi do when he comes to this passage? Ad ki avo Shiloh, he says, means until the King Messiah will come. Now, obviously, just I'm sure it's clear to everybody, it isn't that Rashi thinks that Jesus is the Messiah, but he thinks that this is a messianic verse. You saw here the JPS translation. There's nothing messianic in the JPS understanding, the Jewish Publication Society understanding of this verse. And we will see next week. We'll see Rashbam's commentary on Genesis 49:10, where he clearly takes on the Christian understanding and says, "No, there's nothing about the Messiah here in this verse." So. Here are two verses in Genesis that are often cited by Christians. For the last 2,000 years, Christians citing Vayachsheveha lo tzedakah, about Abraham's faith being that which made him just, and citing this verse to say that the common Christian teaching about this verse was that what it means is Jews will have power until Jesus comes. And very often Christians argued, well, take a look at what happened in history after Jesus came. That was the end of Jewish power. Jewish powerlessness began when Jesus came. It's a far-fetched interpretation of the verse, but that was the standard understanding of the verse. And it involves understanding Ad ki avo Shiloh as a messianic phrase, which it doesn't have to be a messianic phrase. There are other ways of understanding it, but Rashi just says it means until the King Messiah shall come, who's will be the kingdom. And Unkelos says this same thing. So Unkelos, we know, was not arguing against Christians. If Rashi is arguing against Christians, and if he knows what Christians are teaching, then it would be surprising for him to say this without qualifying it in some way. Okay, so here we've seen two examples of Rashi not taking the gambit of seeing an opportunity of arguing against Christianity. Some of you, I've noticed some of the people who are coming to these Zoom classes were students of mine at York University years ago. And I'd like to say to those of you who were students of mine at York University many years ago, that about the next text that I'm going to be teaching, I've changed my mind. And if you were a student of mine enough years ago, I taught it a very different way than I'm teaching it now. So I think it's okay to change your mind as the years go on and you learn more things. I just wanted to point out, you know, the comparison here with Rashi saying King Messiah here, when we saw last week a psalm that the Christians had interpreted about Jesus, what Rashi wrote here. The rabbis interpreted this psalm as referring to the Messianic king. It is fitting to interpret it about King David himself as an appropriate refutation of the heretics who found in it support for their heretical beliefs. So I'm not going to interpret this psalm about the Messiah, even though the rabbis interpreted it about the Messiah, because this gives strength to the Christians. But Rashi didn't do this in Genesis 49:10. He says this is Messianic. Okay. Now we go on to the text that I've changed my mind about over the years, which is Rashi's commentary on the first verse in the fourth chapter of Genesis. Just read through the biblical verses of the end of chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 4. The end of chapter 3 is the banishment of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden after eating of the fruit. So the Lord God banished him from the Garden of Eden to till the soil from which he was taken. He drove the man out and he stationed east of the Garden of Eden the Kiruvim and the fiery ever-turning sword to guard the way to the tree of life. Now, the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived. This is the JPS translation. We're going to talk about the translation soon. Now, the man knew in the biblical sense, his wife Eve, and she conceived, and she bore Cain, saying, I have gained a male child with the help of the Lord. She then bore his brother Abel. Okay, so we see the order of the text here. They are kicked out of the garden. They sin, they're kicked out of the garden, and then chapter 4 begins, Ve'ha'adam yada et chava ishto. Rashi's commentary on this verse, Ve'ha'adam yada. Kvar kodem ha'inyan shel mala, kodem shechata v'shenitrad migan Eden. Adam yada, his wife Eve, means that he had known his wife Eve before the events of the previous story, before he sinned and was thrown out of the Garden of Eden. I used to teach this text as being a clear example of Rashi polemicizing against Christianity because of the Christian teaching that sexuality is a result of the fall and a result of eating of the fruit. And this, I used to teach that this repeated language here in the beginning of Rashi's comment, kodem ha'inyan shel mala, kodem shechata v'shenitrad, before the events of the previous story, before he sinned and was thrown out of the Garden of Eden, it looks like he's arguing against something, and it makes sense to argue that he is arguing against Christianity. Okay, we'll see we'll see the rest of Rashi's commentary soon, but just I took one of the church fathers I found, John Chrysostom, writing in his homilies on Genesis. Whence, after all, did he, Adam, come to know that there would be intercourse between man and woman? You know, how did people figure out that there was such thing as sexual intercourse? I mean, the consummation of that intercourse occurred after the fall. That's when they had intercourse. It was after the fall. Up until that time, they were living like angels in paradise. And so they were not burning with desire, not assaulted by other passions, not subject to the needs of nature, but on the contrary, they were created incorruptible and immortal. And on that count, at any rate, they had no need to wear clothes. Consider, I ask you, the transcendence of their blessed condition. Think how wonderful human life was in the Garden of Eden, where people had everything and where they didn't have these terrible burning desires that human beings now have, these passions that human beings have now. This is the blessed condition that they had when they were, and this was, I'm sure you all know, this is a common Christian teaching that goes back at least to John Chrysostom and probably before John Chrysostom. And so is Rashi in his comment here arguing against against this when he emphasizes here that Adam knew his wife Eve before the events of the previous story, before he sinned and was kicked and thrown out of the Garden of Eden. Okay, I have stopped teaching that that is the meaning of this text, and now I'm going to tell you why I've stopped teaching that that is the meaning of this text. First of all, let's look at the continuation of this text. So also, the pregnancy and the birth were in Eden. He's not just arguing that the sexual intercourse took place in Eden. He's saying that also the pregnancy was entirely in Eden and the babies were born in Eden. You know, if you're trying to argue against Christianity, you don't have to say that. So why is he saying that? Had the text said, he goes on, Vayeda Adam, then it would have meant that his children were born after he was thrown out of Eden. Notice that the last line of Rashi isn't, had the text said Vayeda Adam, then it would have meant that they had intercourse after they left. At the end of the comment, Rashi is not emphasizing the intercourse part of it. He's saying that all of these things took place in the Garden of Eden. And Rashi has an interesting grammatical, syntactical point that he's making about that verb there, v'ha'adam yada. Those of us who speak modern Hebrew, we look at a phrase like v'ha'adam yada, and that looks totally normal to us because that's how you make the past tense in modern Hebrew. That's the only reasonable way to make to construct a past tense in modern Hebrew. But that is not the common way that a past tense is made in biblical Hebrew. In biblical Hebrew, the standard way of making the past tense is that all of those standard past tense verbs are in red here in my chart. Vayishalchehu, God banished him from the Garden of Eden. The next one, Vayagaresh et Adam, he drove the man out. Vayashkein mikedem leGan Eden, and God stationed east of the Garden of Eden the Kerubim. And then we have v'ha'adam yada. We don't have vayeda adam. We don't have what the grammarians call the vav ha'hipuch construction, the vav consecutive construction. We have what looks like modern Hebrew here, v'ha'adam yada. And then the rest of the verbs after that go back to being vav consecutive. Vatahar, vatelet, vatomer, vatosef. She conceived, she bore, and then she said, and then she bore his brother Abel. So Rashi says that when they use this construction here, v'ha'adam yada, instead of v'yeda adam, it's a pluperfect. Rashi's making a grammatical point. He's pointing out the difference between these two kinds of past tenses. There isn't a simple form for a pluperfect in Hebrew, in modern Hebrew. It's something that's missing in modern Hebrew to have a simple way of saying that I had known instead of I knew. To make that distinction in modern Hebrew is very difficult. And it has been argued that one of the ways that the pluperfect is done in the Hebrew Bible is through a phrase like v'ha'adam yada. Another example of this, where I think it's clear that this what looks like a simple past tense is actually a pluperfect in the story of Laban looking for his household gods. It says that Laban went into Jacob's tent and Leah's tent and the tents of the two maidservants. He didn't find them. Leaving Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. We have all those verbs there in the standard vavayipuch method. Vayavo, vayetze, vayavo. And then we have v'Rachel lakha et hatrafim. And almost every translator realizes here that this is a pluperfect. Rachel had taken the idols and placed them in the camel cushion. This isn't, we have a list of verbs going on one after the other, but this, that phrase, v'rachel lakcha, instead of v'tikach rachel, tells us that it's a pluperfect. But the simen b'charagama v'teshev aleim v'yimashesh, there, and then we have more vav consecutive constructions, because there the actions are taking place one after the other. So, why is Rashi saying what he says about v'ha'adam yata? It's could be because it's the first time in the Bible that we have this use of the pluperfect with a phrase like Veha Adam Yada. So Rashi's explanation could simply be a grammatical, syntactical interpretation. Furthermore, when we look at other Jewish commentators who are known to be polemicists against Christianity, Radak, who we'll talk about in a couple of weeks in this mini course, Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, at the end of the 12th century. Despite the fact that Radak really knows Christianity well, Radak disagrees with Rashi, and he says, Adam knew his wife Eve. Once his instinct of sexual desire was aroused from eating from the tree, and his wife's also, he knew her, and she conceived. Either 7 or 9 months later, there's no proof from this verse that she conceived and gave birth on the same day, as the Midrash writes. That Radak, the well-known Jewish polemicist, feels no necessity of trying to counter Christian claims about sexuality in his commentary on Genesis chapter 4. And another well-known Jewish polemicist who we'll also see soon, Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, also from the second half of the 12th century, also insists, in fact, that sexuality began only after they left the garden. He writes, the blessing which God gave to them, to Adam and Eve, ostensibly on the sixth day of creation, be fruitful and multiply, was actually not given to Adam and Eve until now, after their sins, for only now did they need to reproduce. So in other words, there were a lot of Jews who were teaching, even Jews who were polemicists against Christianity, were teaching that that's also what Judaism says, that the Jews also understand that sexuality was only after the sin. So we find, first of all, that Rashi has a grammatical, syntactical reason for what he's doing. Second of all, we find that other polemicists aren't interpreting this passage in a polemic way. And finally, the last argument that I have is that Rashi is simply following this midrash in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that he liked it, because that's what he's doing in his commentary here. Rabbi Yochanan ben Chanina said, the day of the creation of humans was 12 hours long. In the first hour, Adam's dust was gathered together. In the second hour, it was formed into a shape. In the third, his limbs were stretched out. In the fourth, he received his soul. I skipped a couple of hours. In the seventh, he was matched with Eve. In the eighth, two climbed into bed, and four came out of bed. Adam and Eve climbed into bed on the eighth hour, and then they came out with twin boys. In the ninth hour, he was told not to eat of the tree. In the tenth, he sinned. In the 11th, he was judged. And in the 12th, he was banished, and he left the garden. As it is written, man will not sleep in glory. That Adam and Eve actually never spent a night in the Garden of Eden, according to this Midrash. It's interesting to think about what the meaning of this Midrash is for another time. But Rashi is clearly just following this Midrash, when he says in the comments here that sexuality was in the garden, and the birth was in, and the pregnancy was in the garden, and the birth was in the garden. This isn't a polemic against Christianity. This is doing what Rashi often does, which is using Midrashim in his commentary on the Torah. So, to conclude, our conclusion last week, the beginning of the class last week, I said, does Rashi take on Christianity? I said, the one word answer was yes. And the two word answer was yes, but. The but is, but he doesn't do it in his commentary on the Torah. There's no proof that he's doing it anywhere in his commentary on the Torah. He does do it in his commentary on Isaiah. He does do it in his commentary on Psalms. But I see no proof that he does it in his commentary on the Torah. Why would he do it in the commentary on other biblical books and not in his commentary on the Torah? Well, now we're entering the realm of speculation, and I will speculate out loud, but I don't know the reason for this. First of all, it is possible that Rashi's attitude to this changed over time, that Rashi, we don't know the order in which Rashi wrote his various books, but it seems to me to make perfect sense that if you're writing a commentary on the entire Bible, that you would start with your commentary on the Torah, and then you'd go on to your commentary on the prophets and on the writings. And so when he began this project, he was not involved in polemicizing against Christianity. And as the years went on, he became involved. And it's possible that this is connected with the change that happened in the world in the last 9 years of Rashi's life, which was the First Crusade and the massacres of the Jews of many German communities where Rashi had deep roots, where Rashi had had studied. And not only did some Jews convert to Christianity, like under the fear of the sword. There were others who just, you know, saw how things were going against Judaism and were converting to Christianity. And then it's possible that at that point in his life, Rashi decided that he had to try to confront Christianity in his commentary on these books. And it's also possible that it's the nature of the works, that the nature of the commentary on the Torah, as Dr. Yedida Eisenstadt wrote in her doctoral dissertation on Rashi's Torah commentary recently, that Rashi was writing essentially a Midrashic anthology in his commentary on the Torah, and he wasn't doing that in particular in his commentary on Nevi'im and Ketuvim, the later books of the Bible. And so those are two possible reasons why there is this difference, why Rashi in his commentary on the later books of the Bible takes on Christianity, but he does not do this in any easily identifiable manner in his commentary on the Torah. Now I'll take a look at the chat and see if there are some questions that people would like me to rate to. Yes. Somebody asked, who is the nation of atheists? I have no idea who the nation of atheists are that Rashi would be referring to. Yes. The free gift is what Christians call grace or amazing grace. Yes. Is this gift of God to Abraham really grace, a term we Jews tend to avoid? To say that God has done things for me that I do not deserve, I think that Jews do say that that's a chesed, that it's a tzedakah that God does for us. Perhaps we don't use the word grace, which is, as you say, a term that Christians more often use. Yes. Okay. Version one is Hertz's translate. Hertz translates in the same way. Yes, most of the translations do follow Paul. Yes, is not tzedakah justice or rightness. Tzedakah is a word that has many different meanings in biblical Hebrew, and one of them is justice and rightness. Tzedakah, there are phrases in which tzedakah means something that's done for someone that they do not necessarily deserve. Yes. Okay. Okay. Yes, all the people that Shaddai quotes on 15.6, Arthur points out, come after Rashi, could it be that they are all protesting? It's possible. I could imagine, Arthur, that Rashi was capable of coming up with this kind of understanding, but it is interesting that I haven't found it clearly in somebody before Rashbam. Yes, somebody suggests the yikat might be connected with yichas. It doesn't quite work with the letters. Yes, so Professor Basser gives us a quotation from James in the New Testament. You say you have faith, for you believe that there is one God. Good for you. Even the demons believe this and they tremble in terror. How foolish! Can't you see that faith without good deeds is useless? So Professor Basser points out correctly that even within the books of the New Testament, some of the New Testament books don't buy into this model of Paul, that all you really need is faith. Thank you, Professor Basser, for that. Is it not both aspects, complete faith in God's promised him as well as actions which give proof of his faith? Somebody wrote that to me privately. And I think that that's a good thing to say, that those are both good things, to have faith in God and to follow God. Yes.
Marty.
Yes. Pearly, please.
I can't use the chat yet.
So go ahead. Use your microphone. That's great. Go ahead, Pearly.
The Midrash, the one where he's using the pluperfect, okay? Is that the only time that the grammar and the Midrash match in his Midrashim on the Torah? Or
no, it's a great question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but you know, he has grammar and Midrash on his side, which we know, Pearly, doesn't often happen. You know, the Midrash sometimes plays fast and loose with the grammar and the syntax, but he's got both of these things going for him here. I can't off the top of my mind come up with another example. I see somebody who might have been a student of mine has asked if there are any retroactive grade changes if I change my mind about the meaning of this text. You could write to me privately by email and we could discuss the retroactive grade changes. Yes. Okay. Well, I think that I've dealt with most of what I understood there in the chat. I look forward to seeing people next week. If you're interested in coming back, I will be here, and I wish you all a good week in the meantime.